It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the author of the new book, Anxious Eaters, tells us why fad diets are such a big business in the United States and what they tell us about our culture. First, Wisconsin has a record $6.6 billion projected budget surplus. But many local governments face budget troubles. Some of them held referendums last year to raise funding for basic services. Local leaders are calling on the state legislature to take a new look at the way the state shares revenue with the locals. Shared revenue from the state, along with property taxes, are two of the largest sources of funding for local government services. Governor Evers has proposed increasing shared revenue by 10% over the next 2 years. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has repeatedly said that municipalities won't get more money from the state without spending reforms. We'll start our look at Wisconsin's shared revenue system with a newly elected Republican state lawmaker. Then we'll get the perspective of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see a change? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. Republican Assembly Representative Bob Donovan was a Milwaukee alderperson for 20 years. He now represents the 84th Assembly District that includes a bit of Milwaukee. At his swearing-in ceremony, Representative Donovan was joined by the Republican Assembly Speaker, along with the Milwaukee Mayor and County Executive, both Democrats. I talked to Representative Donovan last week. Well, you've got an interesting perspective on local government funding. I want to start with your days representing Milwaukee in the local council there. What was your view of the shared revenue situation from that vantage point?
Well, certainly the challenges that Milwaukee faces, not unlike most urban centers across America, crime issues, poverty, issues like that, that are a real challenge. And the need to get some help and coordinate and create a partnership with the state of Wisconsin has always been one of my desires. And I think most elected officials in Milwaukee would, in one way or another, say the same thing. A budget like Milwaukee's, they do need help from the state. They certainly need to create that partnership. And I'm hopeful that my position in the state legislature can help move something like that forward.
Yeah, I would say over the last 10, 12 years or so, when you hear Milwaukee and Republicans in the state legislature in the same sentence, it might be against or versus, a little kind of a combative relationship. From what I'm seeing from some legislative leaders, from the mayor, the county executive there, it seems like people are trying to make nice. Do you think that's really a possibility?
I do. I sense that there is a desire to get some things done. I'm hopeful that that's the case. Certainly my conversations with representatives from up north, they're telling me that it's just not Milwaukee. A lot of municipalities across Wisconsin are in need of a change and an increase, certainly in shared revenue and help from the state. So I'm optimistic that some good things can happen in this current environment.
There's been concern, I think, from some local government leaders that any increased funding might come with strings attached, changes to the budget or the way they operate that they might have to make. Do you think that there should be some strings attached?
Well, I do. I certainly in my conversations with leadership in the Republican caucus, yes, they'd like to see some transformative changes the way we do and provide local government. I think there are opportunities to perhaps do things differently, to perhaps look at ways that we can improve services and keep our costs at a minimum. That's always a challenge, but certainly I think there is a willingness to understand that things have got to change. I sense that from the people I'm talking to in Milwaukee, and they accept that.
And as you mentioned, this isn't just Milwaukee. When you're talking to local leaders, wherever they are, what concerns are they raising? Are they saying, if we don't get this boost in shared revenue, blank is going to have to go?
Well, yeah, some of the suburbs, of course, I represent about 10 wards in the city of Milwaukee, but I also represent the city, most of the city of Greenfield and Hales Corners and a portion of Greendale. So they're telling me that, yes, they are really fighting to try and make ends meet. So I'm hopeful that that recognition can move forward, that the people in Madison, and I sense that they do, they realize that this time we've got to move some things forward.
And we've been talking about a shared revenue, the idea of taking, you know, a piece of the state budget, a bigger piece, and sending it back to local governments. Some local communities want the opportunity to boost their sales tax, half a percent or whatever the number might be. Is that something you see as a solution in at least some communities?
Well, I think perhaps in some communities it makes sense, in others it may not. I think before we move forward with something like that, I think we need to see precisely how it's going to be used. I know that there's a desire on the part of many to see some significant improvements in public safety in Milwaukee. I certainly would be one of them. So the horrendous pension problems that Milwaukee and Milwaukee County are experiencing, the crime problems, all of these things take significant amounts of money. So certainly the sales tax was one option that was put on the table.
And do you see, before we wrap up, Representative Donovan, a timeline where we might have some legislation on the table?
Well, I know some of the leaders in Madison would like to see this done in a hurry. I hope that in that process, we don't make some mistakes along the way. I'd rather take a little more time and get it right. That's my personal opinion. But having said that, I know there's a sense of urgency. And so I assume that things, if they move forward, may indeed be moving forward in the next few months.
Representative Donovan, thanks again for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you.
That was Bob Donovan, longtime Milwaukee Alder, now representative of the 84th Assembly District. We're talking there about the funding of local governments and services in Wisconsin and the shared revenue they rely on from the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see a local budget crunch in your community? Did you have one of these basic services funding referendums that happened in the last election? Call 800-642-1234. Jerry DeShane joins us now, Executive Director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. Jerry, welcome back to the show.
Oh, good afternoon, Rob. Thanks for having me.
I know there's probably a lot of variety around the state, but can you give us a sense of the current fiscal health of our local governments in the state?
There's a cliff within sight. How's that? We polled, there's 190 mayors in Wisconsin. We polled them and said, can you sustain the local services that you have on the books right now for the next 2 years? 90% of them said no. The system's broken, Rob. And we are fast approaching that place where local governments are going to have to make some frankly rather draconian cuts. I don't think we get there, but that's really the point we are at.
How big a part of that cliff is shared revenue as you see it?
As you pointed out in your conversation with, and I keep wanting to say Alderman, your conversation with Representative Donovan, shared revenue is one of the biggest parts of the state budget. It's one of the top five or six in dollar terms. It's one of the top five or six. It's also the second largest piece of revenue for local governments, behind only the property tax levy. So it's big. It's very big. How much of a local budget it is sort of varies by municipality. It can be as much as half of a local budget. It can be as little as 5 or 10% of a local budget. But statewide, it is a big deal.
Is there a sense among the mayors you talked to that, in effect, they're getting an unfair deal from the state over the years, that they're not getting what they should be due, given you know, their community's contributions to the state revenue?
Rob, can I adjust our language just a little bit? I don't want to say that it's unfair. What's happened is about three decades ago, we unplugged shared revenue from the economy. We stopped increasing shared revenue as the economy grew. And if you do that for 20 or 30 years, what happens is local governments are no longer, they don't have the ability to keep up with their own economy. levy limits on property taxes in Wisconsin, keep property taxes well, well, well below the rate of inflation. And, you know, you can say, hey, that's good. But on the other end, those communities keep growing and shared revenue has not been keeping up. In fact, in real dollar terms, it's gone down in the last 30 years.
So we're going to call her at 800-642-1234. Joy is with us in West Bend. Joy, hi.
Hi. Wow, this whole thing is reminding me of how the schools are not fully funded. But anyway, I called about a county. I guess I hope that's considered a municipality. But I live in Washington County, West Bend, and here our public nursing home is being discussed. County supervisors are devising a plan to put the residents in some kind of private. We're afraid of this anyway, that they're going to close down the nursing home rather than remodel it or rebuild it. It's been costing money in the last few years, and I would like to know what other communities do about that. There must be some counties that still operate nursing homes, and why couldn't our surplus of the state money be used partly for that?
Joy, thanks for the call. Jerry, I know you represent municipalities, but I believe counties are in the a similar boat when it comes to shared revenue. Is that part of the story why a public nursing home like Joy's talking about might be in jeopardy?
Absolutely. And counties, the good news, Joy, is that counties are at the table and are part of this discussion over shared revenue. Because, yeah, I mean, you've made the case, Joy, better than I can. This is an essential service. I mean, those senior citizens, those folks with disabilities, whatever put them in the nursing home, that's a critical need. We have to deal with those citizens, and shared revenue is a big part of being able to sustain that.
Thanks for that call, Joy, at 800-642-1234. We're looking at local government budgets here in Wisconsin, the shared revenue they get from the state. Jerry DeShane stays with us, executive director with the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing the impacts of tight budgets in your own local community? Do you want to see more of this money coming from the state to local communities? Are there strings you'd like to see attached? If so, what would that be? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Jerry DeShane, Executive Director for the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. We're looking at shared revenue, the way the state government divides money up with local governments, why local leaders around the state say they need more of that funding. We need to, they say, recalibrate, refigure out how that's working. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing the impact of tight budgets in your community? Did you see a referendum on the ballot in the fall to help pay for some of the basic services? Do you have questions about how all this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before I go back to our callers, Jerry, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has said, willing to look at this, but he has said there need to be some local spending reforms at the same time. What kind of things might that look like?
We've had several meetings with the speaker, and I want to say this first of all. When we went into his office the first time and just talk about this, he put his hands up in the air and said, look, you don't have to convince me. I know there's a need out there. But then we got into this discussion about the need for reform. While I don't want to speak for the speaker, I think it's fair to say that what he is looking for is some assurance that local governments are actually looking at the best possible way to do things. Are we spending money wisely? Which, frankly, that's not an unreasonable request. We've been bouncing ideas back and forth with him in his office and with a lot of our local communities. And I'll be blunt, I'm optimistic. I think we're going to get there.
Go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jack is with us now in Milwaukee. Jack, hello.
Hello. I guess my question here is, because you're kind of the expert on what's going on, Is there any serious effort to consolidate services between municipalities? One of the things I get a laugh at all the time is I live across from a Milwaukee Public School playfield. And when our garbage is collected, they come around with our big yellow Milwaukee City garbage trucks. And a few days later, the school system comes out with miniature green garbage trucks to empty a couple of trash barrels in the park. This isn't very efficient, guys.
Jack, thanks for the call. Jerry, consolidation within cities, among different communities, and even city-county consolidation that people talk about, Jerry.
I think Jack has been sitting in with the speaker because we've had very similar conversations. And I will say this to you, Jack, you're going to see consolidation playing a role in these discussions, not mandatory consolidation, because I'll tell you this, one size does not fit all. But there are a lot of services that we could share. There are a lot of things that cities and counties and cities and villages and towns can do together that we're not doing right now. We're working on how do we make that part of the package to incentivize more of that.
Jack, thanks for that call. Jimmy joins us now in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hello.
Yeah, I just my concern is this budget surplus a long-term thing, or is it because of all the COVID money from the federal government? And I think they got to be cautious about funding with long-term programs with it if it's not going to be there for, you know, the future.
Jimmy,
and I'll take my answer off there.
Thanks for the call, Jimmy. Jerry, what do you think? Sustainability here, I think Jimmy's worried about.
You know, Rob, are you only taking calls from people whose names start with J, or is that just
that is how it's worked out? Funny, yeah. It's not the plan,
no.
Jerry.
Jimmy raises an excellent point, and Jimmy, the money, the surplus that they're looking at the state level, by and large, is I don't want to say a permanent surplus. It's an operational budget surplus. They believe that this surplus would continue. So your point is very well taken. You don't use one-time money to fill holes and think that it's going to be there in 10 years.
Jimmy, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Jerry Deshane, Executive Director for the League of Wisconsin Municipalities, about budget problems facing local governments around the state. The idea that there's a state budget surplus, maybe more of that money, the shared revenue, could go to those local communities. Still time for you to call in if you call in right now at 800-642-1234 with your questions, with your experience in your own community. Jerry, talking to Representative Donovan earlier, I think Milwaukee gets a lot of the headlines. Makes sense. It's the biggest city in the state, high-profile budget. This is not just a Milwaukee story we're talking about, though, right?
No, absolutely. And in fact, I would say that the challenges that Milwaukee faces are absolutely no different except in magnitude from the same challenges that, you know, the county that has the nursing home challenge or a town that is facing loss of its ambulance service. It's the system that's broken because it's the same system that funds all of them. And so we're trying to focus on a systemic fix that will help our rural areas and our urban areas because they're all in a very similar boat.
Shared revenue is mainly what we're talking about. Are your members of organizations looking at other prospects for revenue, property tax, sales tax, fill in the blank?
We have talked about all sorts of different options. I think everyone is most comfortable with addressing this problem through shared revenue. You know, it is a simple fact that Milwaukee is the only major size city in the country that doesn't have a sales tax. So that is something that I think needs to be at least talked about, discussed, and possibly given the scope of the challenges there, the need for more first responders there, that may be part of the solution for Milwaukee. But by and large, I don't think you're going to see major changes in property tax systems. I don't see a lot of appetite among legislators for a lot more local option sales taxes. I think a lot of my members would like to see that happen, but I don't think you're going to see a lot of that in this package.
Now, I mentioned those referendums in the fall, Jerry. Usually in the past, I think we're going to have a referendum for a big new capital investment if we're a local government or something like that. what kind of referendums were we seeing in the fall? What kind of things were they looking to pay for?
Public safety. Over and over and over again. There were, 37 of them on the November ballot? And this is a reflection of the problem. Local governments can't keep those ambulance services going. They can't keep the same number of police officers on the street. It just, the math doesn't work. And these are some frugal municipalities that are holding referendums. These are not free spending municipalities. But at some point, they're just no more, you know, there's no more notches in the belt. You can't tighten your belt anymore.
In just our last minute or so, Jerry, I'll ask you the same question I ended with Representative Donovan. What are you hoping for with a timeline on tackling this shared revenue issue for local communities?
The governor is going to introduce a budget bill within a few weeks here. The legislature will process that budget and the governor will sign it, veto it, item veto it before the end of springtime. I would be surprised if we don't work a solution out before that process is over.
Jerry, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Always a pleasure to talk about this.
That's Jerry DeShane, Executive Director for the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. He joined us today to look at the budget crunch many cities and counties are now facing around the state and calls for the state legislature and the governor to change the shared revenue formula, how much state money goes to these local governments, especially at a time of a state budget surplus. Earlier, we heard from newly elected State Representative Bob Donovan about that shared revenue system, his perspective as a Republican who used to be on a city council in Milwaukee in this case. Still time for you to share what you're seeing in your community as a resident or maybe somebody in local government. How big a deal is this to you? Email now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, more and more grocery stores have more and more self-checkout lanes, and a lot of those stores are seeing more retail theft along the way. Find out why and how they're responding. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. There have been lots and lots of fad diets over the years. Some come and go, some stick around. They're hard to miss. There are internet links, social media influencers, books, magazines, videos, and so on, making the case that this diet is the one that's going to help you lose weight, feel better, get happier. And if you look closely, you can find people who debunk those diets and work to expose the faulty scientific claims behind many of them. But in her new book, our next guest does something different. As an anthropologist, she looks at the appeal of fad diets and says, this means something about who we are, what we value, how we relate to our food and to each other. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you moved from one diet to another at some point in your life? Was there one that felt kind of extreme to you? It was hard to keep up with it? Was it difficult to stick with it, or did you? Our guest says Americans are more likely than people elsewhere in the world to embrace these fad diets. Why do you think that might be? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Janet Charzan is a nutritional anthropologist and adjunct assistant professor of nutrition at the University of Pennsylvania. She's co-author with Kima Cargill of the new book, Anxious Eaters, Why We Fall for Fad Diets. Janet, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with a quick working definition. What do we mean by a fad diet?
Well, there's lots of definitions out there. There's a sort of big one that Pennington Biomedical Research Group has 7 points, which I'll tell you quickly. They usually ask the user to eliminate one or several food groups, promise quick results, use personal testimonies as proof of effectiveness, often use only special or certain foods that offer particular advantages. They usually recommend supplements. They're endorsed or advertised by a celebrity, and frankly, they sound too good to be true. And I think you can simplify this to say that they ask you generally to change your food rituals, and they make improbable claims about efficacy. So you're going to get a really great outcome, a magical thinking outcome. And almost always you're being asked to buy something.
Now, people argue about the nutritional value, the dietary value of these diets. You go a little deeper, and I'm going to quote from your book here. You write, a diet is not just a set of behaviors, but a belief system, a consumer product, and a social identity. What led you to want to take these diets and look into, you know, what they mean in our lives?
Well, I've been working with food for a long time, obviously. You know, I teach students, but I do community work. I started a farmer's market, and I've done research with maternal and child health care. And the minute I tell someone what I do, they immediately tell me about what their latest diet is. And they have such a look of hope in their eyes. And if I have a face that shows any doubt whatsoever, they get a look of kind of fear. And often,
I think we've lost our guest. Janet Charzan is author of the new book, Anxious Eaters, Why We Fall for Fad Diets. We'll reconnect with her in just a moment, but you could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have experience with what she described as fad diets. If you know somebody, maybe, who's bounced from one to another, can you talk about the kind of things you've seen there and why these fit into our culture, and why, and we're going to talk about this in just a moment, why it seems especially American to be into these kinds of fad diets. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We also have a spot on the Ideas Network Facebook page for you to share your thoughts. We'll come back, hopefully, with a guest on the line. Oh, do we have her? Janet, okay, we've got you back. We don't. We'll come back, hopefully, with guest in hand here on Central Time. Again, you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Janet Charzan, nutritional anthropologist, author of the book Anxious Eaters, Why We Fall for Fad Diets. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have experience with these diets, your own or someone else, questions about what they mean to us, why they've become so popular and remain so popular over the years, 800-642-1234 is the number to call or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Janet, you write in the book that Americans seem to be particularly into fad diets as compared to the rest of the world. And you talk about some of why that is. Why is that?
Well, I think broadly speaking, you know, we have so many different cultures in our country. We don't have necessarily an established food culture because we are a bricolage of cultures and peoples. And so there's a lot of information coming in, right, about what we can eat and what others can eat. So that's part of it. I think part of it, too, is that we believe strongly that consumerism can solve problems. So if you're given the option of, hey, you can buy into this diet and, you know, you'll lose 5 pounds a week, that sounds pretty good to us. And we also tend to be really individualistic. And so it's easy to think, okay, well, I can choose this diet for myself and I can make a real change. I can transform myself. We also believe in self-transformation. So all of that kind of comes together to make it easier for us to believe that, yes, if we go for this particular diet that maybe our cousin told us about, that we too will have these phenomenal outcomes.
I think I get the sense reading your book, you are maybe skeptical about the nutritional and dietary value of many fad diets, but you write they make cultural and psychological sense. You're not like beating up on people who try these diets. How do they make cultural and psychological sense in a way that makes them so appealing to us?
Yeah, they make absolute sense. They rely on narratives that are cultural narratives that become almost truisms that once we buy into that, once we start thinking, well, of course that makes sense, it's easy to just buy into the diet. So, for instance, I think many people in the United States have really come to believe that carbohydrates are kind of scary and hinky and sugar is bad. And that's not necessarily the case. We need carbohydrates. But so if a diet is presented as something that's going to decrease your sugar cravings and make you healthy, you're going to say, hey, that sounds good. I know that'll work because I believe this background narrative.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jane is with us in Madison. Jane, hi.
Hi.
I was wondering if the author has studied this, broken it down into what, say, gender category, or what kinds of people are more susceptible, what categories of people might be more susceptible to diet fads. And I thought of one other question, too, while I was waiting. It sounds as though people buying into these diet fads, it isn't based on science. And is that kind of an indication of the science that is lacking in our population?
Jen, thanks for the call. Let's tackle that first question first, Janet. Do these things break down demographically, men, women, and other categories as you see it?
No, they don't. And that's one of the things that's fascinating, is that across the board, this promise of self-transformation appeals to everyone. And so there's really no difference if you look at who's interested in these diets between, you know, regions of the country, ethnicities, races, ages, genders. It doesn't really matter. Now, some diets seem to appeal for whatever reason, because of often they're transmitted by certain kinds of influencers, may appeal to one population or one group of people, maybe a little bit more than another, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't appeal to others. So, for instance, paleo is very popular among men who like to lift weights. But it's also popular among women who are interested in making sure their children are as healthy as possible. And so the narratives that you read online, the narratives that you learn about when you buy the books, et cetera, those narratives are designed to appeal to everyone so you can sell more books.
And Jane also asked, I think she was getting at scientific literacy. Are we willing to buy exaggerated claims or even false claims because we don't, I guess, get the science?
You know, again, I think I want to give us a pass on that one and pat us on the back. I think, yeah, we all know that we need to know more about science. I teach about science, so I'll say that. But I think that the claims made by these diets and the stories, the narratives, are so compelling that it would be really hard for almost anyone, even a well-trained scientist, to step back and say, oh, well, maybe, you know, because the hope is so powerful, well, maybe that doesn't make sense. You really have to dive down into the books and into maybe the discussion threads to hear where it doesn't make sense. And sometimes it would only really make sense to somebody like me who's trained in nutrition. So I think they're very compelling, and I think they're compelling to a lot of people.
Thanks for that call, Jane, at 800-642-1234. Janet, as you write about this wide variety of fad diets, a lot of them are very stringent. They require giving up categories of food and following a plan, sometimes timing your meals in particular ways. It sounds hard, but in some ways, is that part of the appeal? Like, if I take this on, I feel like I'm really taking action here.
Man, you really did read the book, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
Absolutely, and in fact, well, I think of it in terms of sunk costs, an economic term, which is the more we invest in something, the more we have a hard time giving it up. And what happens if you've bought the books and maybe the special foods and you've really changed your food habits and maybe you can't go out to dinner with friends and you're really changing your day-to-day life, you've got so much invested at that point that it's really hard to start thinking, well, maybe this isn't working, or maybe this is not working very, very well, or maybe I'm really unhappy doing this. So we really invest so much that it's hard to walk away.
And one thing that struck me, there was a kind of a case study of a couple in the book who would alternately go for a couple few weeks on a really stringent diet. And then when they bailed out on it, it's, you know, pizza and tater tots and beer for supper every night and no middle ground. I imagine that's probably fairly common, that sort of back and forth.
Absolutely. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why these diets often fail, which is that it gets dichotomized. Like when you're on the diet, it's sort of an all or nothing. You're being virtuous. You're being in control. You're being good. And then when you have a little slip,
oh, let me go have that ice cream, you know, or, oh, okay, I'll go have that martini. Whatever that is that you're not supposed to have that's on that diet that's pure and that's good and that's clean and that's going to make you the person you really want to be. Once you kind of stop doing it, all of a sudden, oftentimes, people will just go crazy and have a rabble-izian time of it and then say, oh, well, I just don't have it in myself to control myself in such a way to continue the diet, so whatever, I won't do it anymore. And then the next diet comes along, and, you know, maybe their cousin tells them about it, and they say, well, maybe this will be the new one that really works well.
And you mentioned the diet failing, and I imagine if you're in the zone, if you're in the mindset of these diets, did the diet fail me or did I fail the diet? How does that kind of accountability work for people?
Absolutely. You've nailed it. And I think what happens is people feel that they've failed the diet and that they're not worthy, maybe not even worthy of losing weight. I don't know. That if they just did the rituals right, you know, if they just avoided the right foods or took the right supplements or ate the foods in the right order at the right time, whatever the restrictions are, that they too would have success. Because when you read the books or hear the diet gurus or sometimes even read what other people on chats and the various websites are saying, many people say, wow, this was so successful for me. And so, you know, I don't know how often those people are paid to say that. They might be. But it's really hard to say, well, maybe there's something wrong with the diet. Again, you've got the sunk cost. You paid for a bunch of stuff, even if you just paid for time.
Talking to Janet Charzan, nutritional anthropologist, co-author of the book Anxious Eaters, Why We Fall for Fad Diets. You can join in if you have an experience to share, a question about the cultural and social role of fad diets. Call it at 800-642-1234. If you're on one of these diets, you feel kind of insulted that we're calling them a fad diet? Share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Janet, you used a word a few moments ago, virtue. And that seems like such a big part of the story as you tell it. We, in American culture anyway, I don't know if elsewhere, we associate eating well and with restraint being virtuous, the way we appear. Thinness may be seen as a sign of virtue. Can you talk about that connection a little bit?
Absolutely. We do, unfortunately. We have those set of connected beliefs. As we know, they're quite dangerous because they can lead people into disordered eating and eating disorders, right? But we do tend to, we say in anthropology, valorize, add value to or give value to certain kinds of practices that indicate that we're controlling ourselves, right? Oh, you know, I'm avoiding sugar and I'm eating clean, or I'm a vegetarian, although vegetarianism is not a fad diet. These are things that people say about themselves, and they're such strong identity statements, right? I am. Or people will say, I'm paleo, not I'm following a paleo diet. And so they're telling something. They're telling a social story about themselves. They're doing a performance. And we rarely do performances where we make ourselves look worse than we think we might be, right? When we do performances, we want to impress other people. So this becomes a way that you can impress other people, right?
But on the other hand, a big part of our food economy is based on us buying and consuming foods that we may be skeptical about. And even, you know, I've grown up seeing ads that show that having this sugary food or soda or beer or you name it is going to make me a fun person with great social connections to the other people I consume it with. No wonder we're messed up about food, right?
Oh, goodness, yes. The cognitive dissonance in all of this, and again, that goes back to why I see this kind of look, an almost crazed look, although the people are not crazy, on people's face, because the cognitive dissonance of trying to find a path through the amazing amount of food that's available to us, the amazing amount of food information that's daily available to us. You know, you can't open your browser, at least I can't, without being told what food I need to avoid permanently. Doctors say, and oof, you know, it's coming at us constantly, and it is confusing. And so if we adopt one of these diets and we think of it as a part of our practice, and especially if other people say, oh my gosh, you're so good, you're not eating bread. Oh, wow. then there's a lot of social reinforcement happening.
Another classic anthropology concept you look at in the book is the idea of purity. We're very concerned about what goes into our bodies and if it will pollute us in some way. How does that factor into fad diets?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Especially with some of these later, as the fad diets have kind of continued, what I see happening is that they start to converge. And so if you had, let's say, the Atkins diet in the 80s, where you're not supposed to be eating very much carbohydrates, that kind of gets added to don't eat gluten, don't eat this, don't eat that. And they start to converge onto this place where your body is really, you're protecting your body from this dangerous outside food. If you take a look at what is, there's no real definition of, for instance, clean eating. But if you take a look at what clean eating advocates say, it's really about a fear of the body being breached by dangerous chemicals, perhaps, or dangerous food items. Things that are either going to hurt the body or, because of their intrinsic nature, cause damage.
Time for another caller. Sarah is with us in Libertyville, Illinois. Sarah, hi.
Hi. Oh, gosh, I can't get you off speaker. I'm sorry. Okay, you asked if I was insulted, and I'm like, I'm a little bit insulted but I mostly just feel like your guest just has some ideas that are just not right. And I've heard it from other people in my life, like, for years, and it's just, they don't know what they're talking about. I don't eat sugar, and the reason I don't eat sugar is because I got super sick about 20 years ago, and I couldn't, and it took me years and years to get better, and the only way I could get better was to eat a completely wholesome diet. And
I got you, Sarah. The connection isn't great, but point taken. I think sugar is an example, Janet. There are some things very common in our food system that many of us eat too much of. There are some legitimate concerns there.
Absolutely, absolutely. We have a food system that's out of whack in many ways. And to approach the caller's point, she has a point. We have our nutritional needs are broadly the same across the species, but we do have individualized nutritional reactions to foods. Some people find certain kinds of foods more difficult to eat, to digest, and they may make them ill. You know, a true celiac disease is a perfect example of that. It's an absolute real condition. It causes immense problems for people. What we see, however, with some of these diets is that they take something like celiac disease, which might affect about maybe 1%, less than 1% of the people, and they say, well, if it's bad for 1% of the people, it must be actually reasonably bad for 100% of people. If it's bad for some of us, it's probably bad for all of us. And that's where it's a problem. Because what happens is people start to restrict their diets. They start to adopt certain practices that then can indeed be disordered eating. And then they can have a very unhealthy relationship with food that's marked by really uncertainty, fear, and a sense of unworthiness, a sense that they're not doing the right thing. And, you know, one of the things that I have to do as a nutritionist is try to get people to enjoy their food, to really embrace and enjoy their food so that whatever changes they might want to make or maybe even need to make can be made within the context of the diet and the foods that they enjoy eating.
That's a good place to leave it, Janet. Thanks again for joining us today.
Okay, thank you for having me.
That's Janet Charzen, nutritional anthropologist and adjunct assistant professor of nutrition at the University of Pennsylvania. Her latest book is Anxious Eaters, Why We Fall for Fad Diets. You can still share your thoughts, your story over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a lot of times our best ideas come to us when we're not looking for them. Explore the magic of the shower moment, times when we solve our problems by doing something different. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and we'll tackle the wide world of casseroles. You can call it hot dish if you want. Get some recipes and suggestions. Join in with your favorites. That's tomorrow here on Central Time.